Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
All right, so today we're here with Dr. Julia Freeman, who is a faculty lecturer at McGill University in the McGill School of Environment, and we're going to be discussing some of the past research that Dr. Freeman has done, mostly regarding biotechnologies and perceptions of biotechnologies in India with regard to cotton. So I guess to start us off, can you explain a little bit about your academic journey and what made you want to get to where you are today?
For sure. And thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. I'm happy to have a conversation about this. So in terms of coming to biotech, it came by way of farmers, actually, because I had a really influential professor. I studied anthropology for my undergraduate and master's degrees, and with an interest in the anthropology of development, in particular, thinking around farmers' practices, largely because I had this very influential, very awesome prof at Simon Fraser, where I did my undergrad, who worked in Mexico with farmers. And I just thought she was the coolest. And I kind of, honestly, I didn't know, like, I didn't have a kind of internal compass on this. I just wanted to keep exploring, and I was inspired by her. And so I kind of followed her lead until I started to develop more of a sense of the things that mattered to me. It was a process, you know? And so I started with that by doing a project for my master's around agricultural practices around coffee, but it was organic production. And as a student, I had worked as a barista, and I had, like, seen that end of the commodity chain. And so, you know, it was cool to see what farmers were doing. And so when I was thinking about my PhD, I became interested in seed banking practices. I had heard a story on the news about a country at war where people had dumped out their seed bank seeds in order to use the containers for water. And I found it really unsettling. But also, I didn't really know much about what seed banks were. And so I kind of started to investigate that. And then I thought, what's going on here with these seeds? And why are people banking seeds? And what's going on? And is this like a new practice or a very old practice with new language? And so I shopped that around with various possible supervisors in anthropology. And a lot of folks said, this is cool. Not totally my thing. It was just on the edge of kind of environmental work enough that it wasn't sort of wholly rooted in cultural ethnographic work. So, and I didn't mean to do that. It just drifted. My interests were drifting because, as I found, as I was working with farmers, you end up working with the land like that. It's there, you know, it's entangled. And so as I shopped that around, and I was hearing this from a few people, and then I landed at UBC, someone put me in touch with a team who had a grant. So there was an anthropologist on that team and a natural scientist, and they were looking at the biotech controversies. They had a policy interest in specialization in sustainability debates, and they were looking in particular at the Indian case. The natural scientist is Indian, and so he had this kind of personal/professional interest, and then the ethnographer was also interested in that case. So I joined that team and kind of get pulled into the biotech world that way. But it made sense as, in a way, because the organic is one whole end of the spectrum around agricultural practices and like the kind of policing of farmer life and like is this benefiting them or not, those kinds of debates. And it's amazing how much that resonates in terms of the biotech conversations too. Like, is this actually happening or helping them? Is it beneficial? What are the unintended consequences? A lot of the questions are the same questions, actually. And so with that funding and that kind of interest in my, I put down the seed bank stuff and got pulled into biotech land, and that was the end of that. I spent the next 6 years working on that project and took a couple of trips to India and learned a lot. Yeah, so that was that.
When it comes to the specific selection of the choice of India being kind of at a different development cycle than a lot of different other countries in the world, like I'm from the US, we don't exactly have a great opinion of Monsanto either, or some crops and how they've affected the agricultural revolution at different times. What would you say that makes this specific impact in India so interesting for you to study?
Oh my gosh, what a great question. So, I mean, India is a country of agriculture par excellence. There's, I think, like 30 million cotton farmers alone. Like, that's like all of Canada. Like, the population-wise, it's just, I mean, it's a lot of people who are doing those kinds of practices. That's one crop. Of course, a lot of the cotton farmers are actually subsistence farmers who grow cotton for cash. And I'm talking about cotton, even though we're talking about biotech, because in fact, BT cotton is the first biotech crop to be grown in India. And it was produced as a public-private partnership with Indian seed developers and, as you rightly point out, Monsanto. Yeah, so BT, so of course, there are many different kinds of biotech crops, but the BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis. I hope I'm pronouncing that even remotely close to correctly. And but it's essentially a soil bacterium that is introduced into the crop, and that bacterium has this property of being toxic to Lepidopteran and pests, so certain kinds of moths, bollworms, mealybug, different kinds of bugs. And the beauty of it from a scientific point of view is that it kills these pests and doesn't harm human health. So that's highly attractive. And it's really interesting that in the moment where you're hearing about like Frankenfoods and suicide seeds and this kind of very, very polarizing fear-based language around biotechnology and BT specifically, often the very same bacterium is sprayed in liquid form on your organic strawberries. So it's one of these things that's like we are holding these tensions and these contradictions, and we don't really the packaging really matters, So if it's produced through the plant, then BT is very scary. And if it's sprayed on top, then give it to your kids, So it's a really it's a funny thing. Now, you were asking about why India. So one of the big theoretical reasons from a kind of PhD project point of view was that we had all of this literature, all of this research that was contrasting a kind of North American willingness to embark on the use of biotech and a kind of precautionary principle approach that was coming out of Europe. And so there was a lot of scholarship at a policy level comparing, like, why are these two kind of very similar socioeconomic regions responding to this technology in such a different way? And what's going on there? How can we, in a lot of cases, how can we get biotech to come to Europe and stuff? That was a lot of the questions. And why is there this worry about it? And of course, the Percy Schmeiser, there's a big debate in Canada about that too, sort of Farmer versus Monsanto, big controversies all over the place. So it was a hot topic. But what was happening, in fact, was that at a square hectare level, more and more of the crops being grown, biotech crops actually being grown, were happening in the global south, or in the majority world, as we would say. But we didn't have the research around it. We were still stuck in, like, you know, US Europe debates, or Canada Europe debates. So there was a real gap in the literature around what does this technology mean in these places. Are the debates similar there? Are the concerns similar? Are the questions similar? Or is this a whole other realm? You know, we have to explore that. So that was, you know, the place that I came into. That's a great wide open field as far as risk scholarship and ethnographic opportunity there. So that was super. But also, just like I say, it's a hugely agricultural country. So the kind of significance of the technology in India is huge and is going to be huge. And once I got into the weeds on the project, and maybe we'll talk about that stuff or maybe not, it's up to you, but there were a lot of specific conditions about life in India, kind of hot points, like agricultural, terrible agricultural conditions, so that, like, farmers were really in need around the moment that this technology was being released. Also, so at the farmer suicide as it came alongside that need, which is a really tragic piece.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Also, farmer rights protections that are unparalleled in the world, and legal institutions like the possibility for what's called public interest litigation, where any citizen can write a writ petition. You could write this thing on a postcard, send it in the post to the Supreme Court, and begin a case. And this was done multiple times to stop the use of biotech. So just a number of kind of levers, conditions, settings that really made for, and theoretical gaps that really made for a pretty interesting chance to go and ask people, like, what's going on here, you know?
Yeah, no, it's super interesting to sort of hear about biotech from, like, a more broad perspective, because a lot of what we do on STEMcast is talking to researchers who are actually developing the technologies, but you don't really get to see the picture of how it's implemented. Sort of just going back to what you had said, can you give us a little bit of background on, like, the socioeconomic context of where your research was taking place?
Yeah, so I did a multi-sided project in India because I wanted to talk to different kinds of stakeholders. But in terms of the context, I think it's really helpful to know that India had been through a green revolution where they were already intervening with their cotton production. So it wasn't like folks were just growing what would be called desi or traditional indigenous cottons and then jump over to biotech. They were already growing hybrid cottons that were high yielding. So there was a set of practices around modified seeds to some extent already. And those yields were kind of bottoming out. So from a whole host, you know, it would depend region by region. You'd have to dig into the specificities as to what was going on. But the larger trend was the arc of cotton production from the 60s into the 2000s was up, 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 and then a kind of precipitous downturn and a lot of loss due to this bollworm pest. And again, I can't overstate the importance of just wrapping your head around like what it actually means. If you have a very small plot of land, an acre, maybe half an acre even, and you're growing your family's food on that land and a bit of cotton, maybe you have as many as 2 acres or a hectare, something like that, you know, but it's not a lot. And you're feeding your family, you're raising livestock potentially, and you're growing this cotton as a means for cash so that you can do the other things like buy school books, you know, medicines, have a marriage or pay for other kinds of things that would come up in a, over the course of a year. Like that's your cash for the year, right? So if you have a bollworm infestation and these could get so bad that your crop could be wiped out overnight, that's very extreme, but you could have, you know, a lot of people were suffering the loss of their sole source of access to cash, because of these changes. And so there was an acute sense of vulnerability already vis-a-vis cotton production in India. And so the promise of these seeds to protect and to be able to resist the bollworm was a really, really big deal. And farmers were extremely, many farmers, I will say, not all farmers, but many farmers were extremely curious and keen to see what this could do for them.
There was one other thing from a little bit earlier that I wanted to ask you to sort of clarify a little bit.
Sure.
You mentioned suicide seeds. So could you
yeah.
sort of explain where that term came from and what it means?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's so I believe Vandana Shiva coined the term. It may be, so she's an anti-biotech activist, and in general, a kind of a very loud advocate for certain kinds of relationships to the land and refusals of commodification through capitalism. And, you know, like you can imagine a whole host. She was an early kind of second wave feminist, very extremely articulate, captivating speaker, very widely known nationally and at the international level. And so I believe she came up with this kind of catchy suicide seeds idea. And the implication was that there was a link being made between the waves of farmer suicides that were happening in Maharashtra in particular. And I didn't personally research in Maharashtra. I was in Gujarat, or rather I was in Andhra Pradesh. A lot of the other research was coming out of Gujarat. But in any case, the idea was farmers were being duped into trying this technology. It was failing, was the narrative. And then they were left with no recourse and committing suicide. Because there were these deaths, it was a very powerful link. And because there was uncertainty around what biotech meant, and because there was this larger North American European debate, there was just enough complexity, uncertainty. It really, the idea of suicide seeds really took off. There's also, they became linked to the idea, oh no, that's Terminator seeds. So that's different still, but it's a similar idea that the seeds would be sterile and that they would, a lot of misinformation, as you well know, I'm sure, but that these seeds would be extremely harmful to land and human life. And I have to say, I guess political rhetoric extremely potent. I personally do find that it's disturbing to take what is an extremely complex situation to understand why these waves of death were taking place, and pin it on a single item. The truth is just much messier. Not all of the farmers who died even grew cotton. There's no discussion about being in debt and how that often pressures. We also need to have conversations about what does suicide mean, if you believe in reincarnation, you know, like what other pressures are happening, what are the I just what does alcoholism have to do with this picture? What are the state levers around being able to borrow? Again, I really feel that is an important part, and it's that messiness and complexity is just not welcome in a conversation that's about creating opposition to the technology. And I will be transparent here and say I came into this project very skeptical of Monsanto's interests in bringing biotechnology to India, very devoted to farmers' rights, and very ready to see things play out in a way that was going to be harmful to farmers. And the truth of the matter was that I did visit a handful of one community of organic farmers that had a lot of support from an NGO to produce their cotton organically. And in the other five communities that I visited, everyone basically said BT cotton is the best thing that's happened to me in 10 years. This has changed my life. I've gone from spraying my crops 30 times a growing season to 3 times maybe. And the huge wave of health benefits and reduced costs from spraying. But honestly, the big one is health benefits, because imagine the way these pesticides are applied. Typically, you're standing in a field, you're surrounded by your plants, you have essentially a kind of pack on your back full of very toxic herbicides and pesticides, and you're spraying and you're soaked. You're inhaling it, you're getting headaches, you're getting nosebleeds. Some people die, it's rare, but it does happen. Miscarriages, all kinds of health consequences, really terrible, serious stuff. It's 30 times. Like, that's a lot. It's like a 9-month growing season or something. I can't, it's a lot. It's a lot to be doing that every year, compared to being down to maybe 2 or 3 times a growing season. That's a big deal. Yeah, so I had to reckon with that and see how farmers were embracing it.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of that rhetoric seems to come from a disconnect in not really realizing the parallels between like what we have in biotechnology versus what we use in conventional and organic agriculture already. Do you think, I guess what I'm trying to say, where do you think that disconnect comes from? Because as you mentioned previously, we use a lot of the same chemicals when it comes to pesticides versus genetic engineering in agriculture. It's just differences in application and, for example, not having to spray 30 times a growing season. Where do you think that disconnect comes from?
I think I'm just thinking about whether it is a disconnect. I think there's a group of people who are very concerned about individual corporations having rights over life. I think that's the fundamental issue. And I understand that, frankly. I do. I think there are good reasons to be concerned, and that doesn't mean there isn't a place and a utility for biotechnology. It means that we need protections in place, and we guide the process as nations, as a global community. I mean, when we're talking about things that are released into the environment, we'd like to ideally have, seeds don't worry much about border crossings. So, as Percy Schmeiser will be the first to tell you. So, I mean, it's, we can have conversations about that if we can get past the demonizing of corporations or of the technology itself or the tool, and the truth is, the farmers were singing the praise of biotech for now. I think it would be very interesting to see, to go back now, this research I did, I was in the field like a decade ago, maybe, more than that, 15 years ago. So if I think about that now, if I were to go back to those communities and say, hey, like, what are you thinking about now? They may well have other things to say. The landscape changes. So I think the farmer priority is, what tool is going to work for me? I have this immediate problem. I want to protect the land as much as I'm able. And also I need to accomplish these other goals on a kind of monthly and annual basis. So it's very practical type work. Likewise, the sort of institutional refusal of biotech, like there's a whole industry around that of kind of pushing back on it. But for me, where it gets interesting and rewarding and worthwhile is when we start to ask, okay, so let's just not toss the whole thing one way or the other. Let's talk about which crops might we want to modify and for what reasons? What places would they be appropriate to introduce and what places might not be suitable for the introduction of a biotech modified seed, for example? What legal protections do we want to have in place? What farmer protections do we want to have in place? What are our thresholds in terms of impact, ecological impacts, for example? We can't get there until we get past the polarizing discourse, but that's actually where all the real work is and the real impact for people's lives is going to be felt, because there was a very hard no in India until farmers got their hands on the seeds and introduced it early. There had been real reticent to release the seeds. They were doing very, very thorough biosafety testing. And, one more round, and the farmers got impatience, just started planting the seeds. So, which I mean, opened a whole can of worms, because then there's black market seeds. Are these real seeds? Are these biotech? Are these not biotech? And so it forced the government to move along in the process and release, safely tested seeds that were ready to go to market and to move that process along. So I don't know. I think that we got to get past the polarizing and meet in that middle space and have some more nuanced conversations in order to be careful and responsible with with an incredible tool. I mean, it really has changed many, many people's lives for the better. And I think whatever your politics, it's hard to overlook that.
Yeah. I guess like sort of coming off of that, a lot of focus on different perspectives is seen out in the field. But when scientists are sort of developing biotechnologies and new plants that can like have this sort of effect, how do we keep the ultimate impact in mind? Are there considerations that you think that scientists themselves should keep in mind when developing a technology like this?
What a super question. My bias is going to be to whatever is experienced near to the farmer. So the projects that I saw that were really cool and that I was really excited about in India were, I mean, there's some stellar work being done at the University of Delhi, at the there's a cotton institute in Nagpur, different places where people have access to very particular seed stock because, cotton, many different kinds of varieties of cotton are grown all over the different regions because there are different ecosystems and they thrive, different seeds thrive in different settings. So to me, producing kind of almost like boutique-y seeds, like these seeds are going to do amazingly well in this region. These seeds are going to, and putting your energy into that diversity is exciting to me because it's going to land well in a lot of different places. It's going to make a big difference. And you're going to maintain that diversity of seed stock as opposed to, collapsing it down into two or three types that are good for market all over. What we have seen in India instead, and this is the kind of corporate logic, and I get why, because Monsanto already has a Roundup resistant seed that they have been able to develop and sell in the US. Roundup is a pesticide. And so the idea is you stack your BT cotton now with this Roundup resistance. So you have a sort of super seed. In India, it was often called double BT. And so you bring in these super seeds, but the labor situation and the ecological situation is different than in the US. In the US, you have these huge, huge, huge cotton farms and, very few farmers for a huge amount of land. And to the extent that you can reduce labor needs, the better. In India, you have a lot of people and small amounts of land. And actually, it can be worthwhile to have people that, like the most vulnerable farmers are not the ones even spraying their own small fields with Pesticides, they're the folks who work on other people's small farms, and they might have that job of picking the bollworm off by hand, you know? So bringing in something, you're going to require costly pesticides to do, you know, that you have to buy the Roundup if you're going to have the Roundup ready seed, is essentially what I'm saying. So that, to me, something that isn't kind of attuned to the needs, but is like already been through the pipeline and is kind of ready for market, and transferring that tech because it already exists, that to me is less exciting than the opportunities to talk to farmers. What do you need? What are you growing here? What are your questions? What are your priorities? I just have that social scientist kind of start from what the people who use it or would use it need. Ask them, just ask, you know. I think very, very, very exciting things can come from that. But I understand that that's a different world, right? And you're not necessarily going to fly to India and like get a car and just start driving around asking people, so what would be useful? But there are people who do that work. And so collaborations, maybe that's what I'm really working towards or thinking about here, is the value of multiple forms of knowledge to enrich the questions, those early questions, not just now we have this thing, how can we put it in the ground here, here, and there, but what do we want to do? What is worthwhile? What does this region need? What are people talking about there? Who's done the ethnographic work? Who's talking to policymakers? Who has a sense of what civil society is up to? Because, you know, it's at your peril if you ignore them. They tried to bring BT brinjal eggplant into the country on the heels of the success of BT cotton. It got shut down in moratorium indefinitely. So, you know, it's not, I may have my gripes with how parts of the debate have been played out, but I do think they ask important questions, and there's we can't pretend that the role of civil society in rolling out new technologies isn't important, you know?
Yeah. With your particular experience in India and with the opinions of those farmers that you've talked about, when it comes to the administrative process in India, what do you think is a good way to incorporate the feelings of those farmers who are most directly affected into future administrative structure as GE becomes more and more advanced and complex?
Yeah, I would say I'm not super up to date on this. I haven't looked at what their regulations are recently. But I will say that at the time I was doing my project, the Genetic Engineering Appraisal Committee was the envy of the world in terms of regulatory systems. It was extremely robust and interdisciplinary in terms of it had a lot of different kinds of people at the table. I remember trying to get them on the phone, you know, are you a member of the GAC? I wanted to talk to everyone. And so many people said, oh, don't talk to me, talk to that guy. Like, he's the biotech person. I'm just on the committee because I have this other kind of background in politics or in finance or whatever it was. So the regulators had a very diverse pool, and a lot of them thought they didn't know about biotech, but they knew other parts of life in India. So they, you know, in that sense, it was super. And a lot of steps. And like I say, the protection, the default, unlike in Canada, the default in India is farmers have the right to save their seeds and replant them. So patent law in India does not play out like it does in other parts of the world. And so that's a really interesting question for a company like Monsanto. They can't enforce patent law the way that they would and have, for example, against Schmeiser in Canada. So very exciting. I think the rest of the world could learn a lot from how India stands up for its farmers. And I mean, I think it's strength in numbers, honestly. I think that they are a powerful political voice, and their numbers are felt, you know. The interesting thing is that at least in the early days of the debate, there was a lot of jockeying to speak on behalf of farmers. You know, like regulators were saying, ah, this tech is going to be so great for farmers. And civil society, there was a lot of like, oh, they're being duped, they're being exploited. Monsanto is going, you know, these are dangerous. And I just can't help but think, maybe we just should ask the farmers. Like, they know better than anybody what they are experiencing, what their trade-offs are, what their vulnerabilities and concerns are, the risks that they're willing to take. So it's, you know, that's where my ear goes to that. I, you know, instead of speaking for, let's just ask them.
So you've mentioned like speaking with farmers a lot, right? Can you take us through sort of a bit of what your research process looked like? How did you sort of navigate language barriers, being in a new environment, all of that kind of thing?
What a great question. Yeah, I mean, this project was like the adventure of my life, honestly. I had always wanted to go to India and I had not traveled there before. I hadn't really traveled very much anywhere particularly. I had done my summer of field research in the Sierra Norte and Oaxaca, Mexico for my master's. For this, I began by studying Hindi for a year and doing my doctoral courses. And my committee suggested that I go and spend a month and just kind of get a feel for the place. Another doctoral student in my program was going to be in Delhi for an air quality conference, I believe it was. And so I think my supervisor, he was supervising both of us. And so he saw a chance to like, why don't you go too, get a feel for life in Delhi? And if you like it, and if you still want to do this project, then we'll proceed. And I think it was really a smart move, honestly, because it was a big leap for me. Yeah, a great adventure. In Delhi, I was working in English anyway. And in fact, I should have been studying Telugu, because as I didn't know, but I would be working more in Andhra Pradesh, and the farmers there were speaking Telugu more than Hindi. So I was studying the wrong language anyway. Anyone that was speaking Hindi was in the north, and they were also very comfortable in English. It was more the regulators, the scientists, those are the folks I was speaking to there. So that first trip, I was really just getting a feel for like, what is it like to be in India? Maybe I'm reaching out to some of the folks who are in Delhi, in terms of regulators, and then other people, civil society people, and just publicly forward people who are speaking, journalists, that kind of thing. And then I came back. I guess I had to do my comprehensive exams, and then I came back, and that's when I did my sort of longer stint. And it wasn't like an anthropology project in the sense that I didn't do ethnographic, like 15 months of field work kind of thing. I did not even 5 months. My brother got married and I needed to come home to go to the wedding, so I kind of crammed it all in. And my visa was delayed. I was supposed to go for longer, but life happens and things get pressured. But I spent about 4.5 months in return to Delhi and then down to Hyderabad as my base there, out into the surrounding areas of Andhra Pradesh, down to Bangladesh, or Bangalore rather. And Greenpeace was based there. Nagpur is where the Cotton Institute was. So I just kind of bounced around the country, but it was more or less a vertical line through the country, through these different environments, and kind of, funnily enough, different positions on the debate. So it was great to see the different perspectives and places, but I didn't have that kind of deep experience of like being in a certain community for many months at a time or anything like that. Particularly with the farmer work, I was there for a few days and then moved to a different place, few days. So, I mean, if I could do it differently, I would love to have had more time in each community. But it's not easy to find a way into these places, you know. It's not like there's Airbnb. Like, it just definitely changes your I needed kind of in, so I, you know, I had a colleague who could translate for me, and I had some research funds so I could hire a colleague from Hyderabad to come with me. And it was like we went to his uncle's community first, you know, just as a place to start. It was very much, you know, we talked about snowball methodology in our research design course, Mian. You know, this was snowball at its best. Like, I need a place to start. Your uncle grows cotton. Super. Let's go there, you know. And we just kind of rolled out from there. So it was, people are very generous, you know. If you express an interest in their work and in their lives, I was absolutely humbled by the hospitality that people showed me. It was astonishing. I mean, I kid you not. In one case, it was actually in this uncle's village. We came, we had lunch, we were chatting, and then I kind of went into the community to speak with other farmers. And in the time that I was gone, the auntie had made me an entire outfit, a whole sari, and like a little blouse and a skirt and the whole thing. And it was, I couldn't, yeah, I don't even have the words to express. Like, here I am, so out of the blue, so disconnected from their everyday lives. And they really showed me a tremendous amount of courtesy and generosity, and that welcoming in. It was really a special experience.
How do you stay hopeful when you're dealing with climate issues and environmental research?
Oh yeah, that's a great question too. I think a lot about hope these days. I work it out in one of the courses I teach around environmental thought, and in a different way in the climate crisis and climate actions course that I teach, contribute. These are team taught courses. I think it's important to start by just recognizing that sometimes you're not hopeful. You know, sometimes it's just scary. And I think being honest about that and being allowed that is the first part of the picture. And then from there, I find there's a really, really wonderful quote by a geographer, Leslie Head, that I come back to again and again, which is that hope isn't necessarily something that we feel. It's something that we practice. And I love that idea. And that's what I turn to, is I find my hope comes from doing. It's not feeling. You got to feel the grief, you've got to feel the worry, you've got to feel the desire for change, but hope emerges in practice, talking with other people, thinking about solutions, identifying them, putting them into the world. Reading and talking and critiquing together. I find that to be a practice. A lot of the courses, you know, in the environmental thought course, we work on a theory of change. Each student gets to really identify their own theory of change. And I find that to be so beautiful. And in the climate crisis and climate actions course, you actually get to make a proposal to do a climate action. And we have things in place if students want to try and make their action happen in on the campus afterwards. So that's, I mean, I feel very blessed to be at a place like McGill with students like you two that are just kicking ass, if I can say that on a podcast. Just so smart and so hardworking and so ready to take on the challenges. But I guess that's it. Like, don't do it alone. Let's work together, whether that's the farmers, whether that's, you know, your peers, whether that's members of your community. That's where we will connect and do our best work. And that's, I think, where I find my hope.
Thank you so much. That was a great way to end. Yeah, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
That was wonderful.
Oh my gosh, well, I really enjoyed it. I appreciate the invite again, and all the best with your work. I really do think you're up to something very, very special and cool here.